Questioning Paul Chapter 3 Part 1 Yerushalayim, Source of Reconciliation.
What really happened in Yerushalayim? Shaul continued his travelogue and autobiography with an inaccurate statement. With respect to the reason for and timing of the meeting in the heart of the Promised Land, the one of the Apostle lied when he wrote.
Later, through 14 years also, I went up to Yerushalayim along with Barnabas, having taken along also Titus. Galatians 2 verse 1.
Yerushalayim is where the covenant was conceived and confirmed. It is the place Yahusha honored Yahweh's promises, and on behalf of the covenant's children observed Passover, unleavened bread, first fruits, and seven Sabbaths. It is the source from which guidance regarding reconciliation of the relationship flow. So it is incomprehensible that Shaul would spend nearly two decades within walking distance of the place and people who witnessed the most important 4 days in human history, and not stop by on occasion to soak it all in. And yet, since Shaul will associate Yerushalayim with the enslavement of mankind two chapters hence, his disdain for Yahweh's favorite place on earth shouldn't be all that surprising. Shaul, and the faith he conceived, would ultimately become adverse to Yahweh's chosen people, promised land, Torah, covenant, and invitations.
I went up, but then downward from an uncovering and set forth to them the beneficial messenger which I preach among the races down from one's own. Galatians 2 verse 2.
As we consider the Nestle-Aland Greek New Testament, 27th edition with MCREYNOLDS English interlinear rendition of this statement to further illustrate the deplorable quality of Shaul's writing, beware that I checked a dozen lexicons and all but one defined kata as downward from, not by. Not a single dictionary listed by, as an option.
I went up but by uncovering and by set up to them the good message that I announce in the nations by own.
If we were evaluating the creative writing assignment prepared by a developmentally disadvantaged child in the 6th grade, we would be inclined to listen to this with a sympathetic ear, but that is hard to do when the scribe is an adult claiming divine inspiration. And keep in mind, the Nestle-Aland is the most universally respected textual resource. In due time, we will come to understand the reason that this unveiling, came kata, downward, why Paul honored Ithemi, set forth and laid down his message as opposed to simply sharing it, and why he did so adios, on his own, uniquely and separately, from anyone else. But between the attitude on display here and the quality of the writing, something remains seriously amiss. In actuality, Paul is lying again. He was compelled to go to Jerusalem as a result of a conflict between his message and the Torah's instructions. This summit would include the most influential men on the planet at that time, Yahusha's disciples, in addition to the leadership of the called out in Yerushalayim. This statement includes the Greek noun wangelion, which is a compound of EU, well done, prosperous, healing, and beneficial, and agalos, messenger, literally means healing and beneficial messenger. While plausible as an extension, it's a stretch to render it good news, as is often the case in Christian Bibles. Also, since the Greek verb kariso, I preach, means to announce, herald, or proclaim, by having used wangelion and kariso together, we can now be certain that if Shaul wanted to say preach, he would have used kariso, not wangelizo, here as well as in previous statements. And this realization exposes the ubiquitous and indefensible translation errors manifest throughout the King James and New Living Translation Bibles. As we are discovering, the epistle to the Galatians was Shaul's attempt to re-establish a tattered reputation, one that had been called into question because he alone, among those claiming to speak for God, was willing to contradict God. Therefore, the best way for him to appear credible while doing so would be to tell us that he and his message had been approved and endorsed by Yahusha's disciples, and specifically by Shimon, Jacob, and Yahochanan, the most influential. And if prudent to believe Paul, they may have given it to him. But if true, it would be a favor Paul would not reciprocate.
But then to the one's opinions not somehow perhaps too foolishly and stupidly I might run or I ran. Galatians 2 verse 2.
This is nearly incomprehensible. So let's confer with the Nestle-Aland Greek New Testament, 27th edition with MCREYNOLDS English Interliter to ascertain whether this is what Shaul actually wrote.
But to the ones thinking not perhaps an empty I might run or I ran.
I suspect the problem is with the quality of the writing rather than the merits of the translations. Plunging into the words themselves, this is the first of five times we will confront opinion, in the context of this letter. Its primary connotation is to suppose and to presume, as well as to hold an opinion based upon appearances. Doke conveys the idea of wanting to see something a certain way, or of someone being predisposed to a certain viewpoint. It is neither flattering nor reassuring. And because it is not thoughtful, this isn't a ringing endorsement. Cutting to the chase, Doke conveys a subjective opinion, as opposed to an objective conclusion. So, in the context of an endorsement on a topic which is literally life and death, and one so easily verified by way of the undisputed standard, Yahweh's Torah, this is a glaring red flag. It gets worse in context, because in addition to the presumptuousness of Doke, we must add the somehow and perhaps aspects of pose. Further, the standard Paulus is claiming to have bested was kenos, stupidity and foolishness. Even I wouldn't accuse Paul of being stupid, false and vain. Well, that's another story. As weak as this supposed endorsement appears, there are reasons to suspect that Shaul's tepid assessment may not even be accurate, or at the very least, it may be purposefully misleading. There is another account, one more credible and detailed than this, expressing what actually occurred during this meeting. And that is why this may be what politicians would call spin, as opposed to an outright lie. And in that light, this is not actually an endorsement of Paul, his message, or his mission. This is more of an indication that something was seriously wrong.
Opinions not somehow perhaps too foolishly and stupidly I might run or I ran.
Even if we could figure out the rest, this still doesn't say what he was running to, for, or from. In that Protestant Christianity is predicated in large part on the King James Bible's interpretation of Paul's theology, it's incumbent upon us to compare these texts, recognizing that Paul actually wrote,
I went up, but then downward from uncovering an unveiling which lays bare, laying down to them the beneficial messenger which I preach among the races down from one's own, uniquely and separately, but then to the opinions and presumptions, not somehow perhaps into foolishness and stupidity, without purpose and falsely, I might run or I ran.
There is no basis for gospel, privately, or which were of reputation. KJV.
And I went up by revelation, and communicated unto them that gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but privately to them which were of reputation, lest by any means I should run, or had run, in vain.
Should this be accurate, why would Shaul consider running from them? He had come to visit with them, and it had been he who had persecuted them, not the other way around. Further, should Paul have actually been inspired by Yahweh, he would have known that God's message is never in vain, only man's. So if he is attributed saying these things, then Paul is providing us with a window into the origin of his message. By adding privately, to this text without justification, biblical scholars, inadvisably trusting their King James Version, have tended to disassociate Paul's description of this meeting in Jerusalem from the detailed account of the very public apostolic council, presented in Acts 15. I can only assume that they do so because when the divergent testimonies are compared, Paul's credibility is shattered and, with it, their religion. It is easy to see where the KJV went wrong. Rather than accommodate the Greek text, they twisted the Latin Vulgate, the translation which gave rise to Roman Catholicism. Jerome's amalgamated rendition reads,
And I went up according to revelation, and I debated with them about the evangelium that I am preaching among the Gentiles, but away from those who were pretending to be something, lest perhaps I might run, or have run, in vain.
Since it does not appear in the Vulgate or in the Greek, privately, may have been deployed by Francis Bacon, the suspected coordinator of the KJV, to steer clear of the Latin translation but away from those who were pretending to be something. Such thoughts regarding those supposedly appointed by God are debilitating for kings and deadly for their subjects. However, by translating Tocate pretending to be something, Jerome and the Roman Church were acknowledging that Paul was deliberately demeaning Yahusha's disciples. And indeed he was. The Latin Vulgate's presentation also suggests that Paul was in competition with others, debating with them, racing against them. In this context, and based upon what is revealed elsewhere, this could only mean that Shaul is trying to dismiss Yahusha's disciples, discrediting them by suggesting that they were pretending to be apostles, while he was presenting himself as being a Dios, uniquely qualified, to run his own race. However, as we have acknowledged, this is actually a lame proposition. If we are to believe that Paul was actually working with Yahweh, and doing what God wanted done, nothing would have caused him to run away from the very men with whom Yahusha had entrusted with his witness. And this is especially disturbing considering what follows, where Shaul condemns Shimon for running in fear. It is becoming increasingly easy to see why so many Christians remain befuddled and in the dark. The popular New Living Translation perpetuates the mistakes inherent in the King James Version, and then adds some myths of their own.
I went there because God revealed to me that I should go. While I was there, I met privately with those considered to be leaders of the church and shared with them the message I had been preaching to the Gentiles. I wanted to make sure that we were in agreement, for fear that all my efforts had been wasted and I was running the race for nothing.
While his intent may have been to skirt the truth by inferring that God rather than the disciples had ordered him to appear in Jerusalem, Paul did not actually say that his unveiling came from God, or that it was the reason for his ascent. The contemporary audience would have immediately recognized such suggestions as disingenuous. There is no reference in Paul's testimony to a private meeting, but instead, Paul speaks of setting forth and laying down the message through preaching, which is public discourse. There is no reference to a church, nor leaders, nor to sharing, in Paul's prose. And the terms Paul selected to frame his statement were all equivocal, and are just the antithesis of making sure he wasn't a foolish, stupid, deceiver, running in vain. As a result, if you have been led to believe that this novel is a translation of the inerrant Word of God, it's time to abandon both myths. In addition to rebuking the New Living Translation for their contrived interpretation of Shaul's letter, it is important to reinforce the fact that those who know that they are presenting the Word of God do not seek the endorsement of others, ever. They rely exclusively on Yahweh. His testimony is memorialized in writing, it is unambiguously and consistently stated, it is available to everyone, and it does not change, making it reliable and those who share it dependable. Further, no matter the response, the time we spend conveying our Heavenly Father's teaching is never wasted. While most human endeavors are run in vain, those who work alongside Yahweh never run his race for nothing. However, those lost in the world of faith don't know, so they are compelled to seek human approval. That is why believers congregate together. Perhaps the inadequate faith of these religious publishers, thereby, seeped into their prose. This is no small matter. It reveals why so many Christians get upset when others don't agree with them. The insecure nature of their faith can't handle the strain of knowing that informed and rational individuals don't support what they have been led to believe. It is as if they worry that the slightest chip on the veneer of their faith will cause everything to crumble. Questioning scares them, so they react by reinforcing one another and collectively pushing the perceived threat away. Perhaps this is why history is rife with many extraordinary delusions and with the madness of crowds, demonstrating that popular acceptance has never been a measure of truth. Said another way, individual deceptions are rare, but collective misconceptions are common. Before we press on to Shaul's next sentence, let's linger here a moment longer, especially since the mother's milk of faith, the specter of supposition, has now been raised. Opinions are to conclusions as faith is to trust. Since Yahusha's disciples had at their disposal a pair of unassailable tests to ascertain for absolute certain whether Shaul was speaking for Yahweh, for himself, or on behalf of the adversary, there was no reason for them to presume anything. God's criterion is straightforward, and it is easily accessible because it is found at the conclusion of His Torah guidance. The best known of these tests contains six elements, with six being the number of man.
1. Is the person a Nabi? Someone who claims to speak on behalf of God. This is a screaming codicil, because if a person admits that they are speaking only for themselves, then there would be no reason for anyone to associate his or her message with God. As for Shaul, he unequivocally claimed to Nabi. 2. Is the person Zid? Someone who oversteps their bounds, speaking presumptuously and contemptuously, with an inflated sense of self-worth, demonstrating self-reliance while taking liberties to defy God, someone who arrogantly pretends to know, who insults others and is disrespectful, displaying pride in the pursuit of personal recognition and acclaim while despising and demeaning perceived competitors, someone who rebels against that which is established and is prone to rage, who seethes with anger and is often furious, overbearing, rude, and conceited in their plans. As we shall discover during our review of Shaul's initial epistle, this could be written to say, does the person act like Shaul? 3. Does the person dabar b'sham? Openly and publicly preach to others, communicating his or her message in the name of God. As was the case with the first codicil, this is also a screening test. If the person has an insignificantly small audience, if his or her statements are exclusively conveyed in private, if his or her influence is limited to a specific time and place without an ongoing legacy or lingering consequence, then there would be no reason to apply this test. But such is not the case with Shaul, whose public preaching and copious letters have influenced billions. 4. Is the person's message low, Suah? Inconsistent with what Yahweh has instructed and directed, does his or her message conflict with what God appointed, constituted, and taught? Does it vary from his instructions? This is where Shaul is the most vulnerable, because his theology is usually the antithesis of Yahweh's teaching. 5. Does the person dabar b'shem utter Elohim? Speak in the name of gods other than Yahweh. When Shaul based his doctrine upon a nullification of Yahweh's Torah, where God's name and this specific instruction are introduced, and upon a misrepresentation and misnomer of Yahusha, while at the same time promoting the graces, he failed this test miserably. 6. Are the individual's written and spoken statements consistent with that which is Hayah, existing and established, instituted by God, and with the test of time? Does what this person says bow? Come to accurately reflect what has happened in the past, and what will transpire in the future. Shaul not only inaccurately conveyed the history of the covenant, the Exodus, and Yahusha's life, he will misrepresent current events, while also failing in his lone attempt at prophecy.
We are still early in our review of this epistle, so not all of the evidence necessary to prove that Shaul failed every aspect of this test has been revealed thus far. But it has been presented here in connection with the reference to Dote, subjective opinion, which Shaul interjected into the previous statement so that you know that there is an objective test. Recognizing this, you are now properly equipped to quarrel with Shaul if he violates Clause 2, of which we already have serious concerns, 4, which will serve as the focus of our evaluation, 5, of which race/grace is a problem, and 6. When he misrepresents the timing of his harpazo, rapture. We'll also be looking for historic chronologies, such as his testimony regarding the Yerushalm summit, as well as other prophetic predictions, because without them, Yahweh's signature and endorsement will be missing. Yahweh's prophetic trademark is required if this, or any of Shaul's letters, is to be considered inspired. So once we have completed our review of Galatians, we will deploy this same test to objectively determine with absolute certainty whether or not Shaul spoke for God. Here is the actual text from which this test emerges.
Surely the person who proclaims a message on behalf of a deity who oversteps their bounds and speaks presumptuously and contemptuously for the express purpose of conveying a statement in my name which accordingly I have not expressly appointed, taught, guided, nor entirely directed him to speak, and who speaks in the name of other gods, indeed, than that prophet, he is deadly. Deuteronomy 18 verse 20.
Mugwth makes the statements of a false prophet deadly and destructive, revealing that those who believe him or her will die. And because this is nothing to trifle with, we should do everything we can to destroy their message before it infects and kills unwitting souls.
And if you actually say in your heart, how shall we actually and consistently know accordingly if the statement which he speaks or writes is not Yahweh's? If that which is deliberately spoken over time by the one who proclaims the message in Yahweh's name is not literally and consistently present and established, or it does not actually come to be, the message which he, himself, has deliberately spoken to influence is not Yahweh's. In arrogance and presumptuousness, the prophet has spoken and written, you should not respect or revere him nor conspire to rebel with him. Deuteronomy 18 verses 21 to 22.
It should be noted that while Haya exists, is instituted, and is established, and Baal come to be, convey somewhat similar thoughts in English. They don't in Hebrew. By using them in conjunction with each other, Yahweh is telling us that if anything a prophet says is divergent from what he has already instituted and established in his word or inconsistent with history, both past and future, this prophet was not inspired by God. Those who speak for Yahweh must, therefore, accurately describe what has occurred in addition to accurately predicting what will occur, while never contradicting anything God has said. So while it will soon become obvious that Paul flunked the prophecy and consistency aspects of this test, don't discount the difficulty of flawlessly reporting prior events. Neither Paul nor Muhammad could do it, and they, thereby, failed the test of history past. In addition, Haya is not only the basis of Yahweh's name, it is related to the Hebrew word for life, J. And the primary meaning of Baal is to go from one place to another, and to arrive, coming upon the scene. As such, by using Haya and Baal, Yahweh, who is the source of life, is predicting the arrival of Yahusha, tangibly demonstrating the power of prophecy. After all, predicting the arrival of the Messiah, while teaching us how to recognize him, was the primary purpose of this test in Deuteronomy/Words 18. Also, depending where the negation provided by Lo is placed in the concluding thought, Yahweh could be saying that a false prophet should not be revered or respected, neither dreaded nor feared. He may be conveying this so that we become more comfortable aggressively exposing and condemning those who deliberately contradict his message. So now that you are aware of this assessment, let's consider another. Yahweh's teaching regarding false prophets was initially broached in Deuteronomy 13. Its evaluation is especially troubling for those who embrace Shavuot because it reveals that we should not listen to anyone who dismisses any aspect of the Torah, who adds to the Torah, or who claims to have received divine revelations, especially if they claim to perform signs and wonders, or if they promote service to or worship of a different god. It reads,
with regard to every word which beneficially I am instructing you with accordingly, observe it for the purpose of engaging in and acting upon it, not adding to it and not subtracting from it. Indeed, if a prophet stands up trying to establish himself in your midst or an interpreter of revelations, and provides a sign or miracle to you, and the omen or miracle worker appears before you who has spoken thusly to you to say, let us go after other gods which you have not known and let us serve and worship them, do not listen to the words of that prophet or interpreter of revelations, because the test of Yahweh, your God, accordingly for you to know is whether this affirms your love for Yahweh, your God, with all your heart and with all your soul. After Yahweh, your God, you should walk, and with him, you should always and genuinely be respectful, and in concert with his terms and conditions, you should continually and actually be observant. Concerning his voice, You should always and literally listen so that, with him, you can consistently serve. And to him, you should always choose to cling. So therefore, that prophet or interpreter of revelations is deadly. For indeed he has spoken rebellious renunciations concerning and against Yahweh, your God, the one who led you out from the realm of the crucibles of Egypt and the one who redeemed you from the house of bondage. His desire is to seduce and scatter you from the way which beneficially, Yahweh, your God, described, providing you with a complete set of directions for you to walk in. And so you can choose to completely remove that which is disagreeable, displeasing, and evil from your midst. Deuteronomy 13:1-6.
I dare say that Paul's revolting review of Yahweh's covenant and his animosity towards his Torah teaching wouldn't engender love or respect for the God who authored and offered them. Therefore, the only way to cling to Paul would be to let go of God. What Yahweh has reinforced with this test is consistent with my personal experience. It wasn't until I took the Torah seriously, closely examining and carefully considering its guidance and teaching, that I came to realize that Paul was a false prophet. The God Paul was describing and the means to salvation he was presenting in his letters were completely different than the God and path I came to know in the Torah. Summarizing this, Yahweh has said that the best way to know who isn't speaking for him is to closely examine and carefully consider every word written. He says that knowing and understanding that his Torah is his source of instruction comes first. Acting upon his guidance and engaging in the covenant relationship is next. Then God says that no one has been or will be authorized to add to or subtract from his Torah. Therefore, if we witness the Torah's role in our lives being diminished, or if we find the writer adding something new, like a new covenant, be careful because such a person isn't speaking for God. Yahweh reveals that if the prophet stands up claiming to have received a revelation from God, and establishes himself, personally speaking his own words in his own name, he is a false prophet. If he claims to have performed miracles, he is a false prophet. If he encourages his audience to go after other gods by other names, like the Roman Grasha or Greek Teres, he is a false prophet. If he promotes religious worship, he is a false prophet. If his writings don't affirm our love for Yahweh, he is a false prophet. If he directs his audience to disregard the terms and conditions of the covenant or the path God has provided for our salvation, he is a false prophet. And of such revelations, God says that they are in opposition to him, both ruinous and deadly, so we should completely remove that prophet's disagreeable, displeasing, and evil stain from our midst.
End of part 1.